I'm Nina Silver, the director of the American and New England Studies program. I am very, very pleased to have this opportunity to introduce Aaron Lechleiter. Aaron is an assistant professor, Professor Lechleiter is an assistant professor of American Studies at the University of Massachusetts at Boston. He received his PhD in American Studies from
here,
Boston University, where he worked with some of our most distinguished faculty, Pat Hills, Bruce Schulman, not here, Marilyn Halter, me.
Is that okay?
It's true.
Yeah. The dissertation that took root here at Boston University then became the basis for his first book, Inventing the Egghead, The Battle Over Brain Power in American Culture. Fabulous cover. Published in 2013 by the University of Pennsylvania Press. He has also published a number of articles in the Journal of American Studies, the Journal of Popular Music Studies, and GLQ, a Journal of Lesbian and Gay Studies. He's at work now on a very exciting new book project titled Love's Next Meeting, Homosexuality and the Left in American Culture. It's forthcoming from the University of Chicago Press. His talk today, well, there you can see the title, Shrieks, Outcries, and Fainting Boys, Homosexuality in the U.S. Cultural Front, and it is drawn from his new work. So, please join me in welcoming back Aaron Lechleiter.
Thanks, Nina. And yeah, it's really, it's a true pleasure to be able to come back to BU because this program, when I was a graduate student, I felt so sustained in the American Studies program. And, you know, Professor Patterson wasn't on my committee, but was somebody who sort of was a key mentor at various points. So it really is a true pleasure to be back here, being able to share with you and get your input on some of the work that I'm trying to get through right now. So one of the things that I've really become interested in trying to develop this project is the question of how homosexuality became so neatly intertwined with what is referred to as the New Left, or the sort of 60s and post-60s iteration of the left in American culture as being something of a symbiotic relationship. So I've just selected one image here of a gay contingent in the Gays Unite Against the War in this, you know, Vietnam era protest moment, which feels sort of natural. It feels like a familiar narrative to understand that the relationship between the New Left and homosexuality is one marked by not friction, but possibility of opportunity as something that is naturally part of the same environment. But the narrative about the old left, so I'm thinking particularly here about the left that becomes centralized in the Communist Party, but also other political parties, socialists and anarchists and so on, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, the relationship that's seen between homosexuality and those political movements is almost always indexed through reference to friction. So the historiography is almost completely consensus. It's almost a consensus that's developed around that historiography. So I've just selected a few examples here of the kind of narrative that's developed around that relationship. So Martin Meeker in 2001 wrote that the use of Communist Party tactics did not serve the foundation for a gay political movement well because its ideology ultimately undermined its politics. Terence Kissick wrote in 2008 that the CP, that's the Communist Party, took a dim view of homosexuality. When homosexuality did appear in the pages of CP publications, it was most often as an occasion for satire. And this sort of follows a narrative that started developing during the Cold War. In 1956, Walter Rideout, who was a literary critic, wrote that for the proletarian novelist, homosexuality came to stand arbitrarily as a convenient all-inclusive symptom of capitalist decay. Robert Schaefer in 1979 wrote that communists in the 1930s viewed homosexuality as a sexual aberration or vice brought on by the tension of life after capitalism. So in trying to think about what the relationship was between homosexuality and leftist politics, I became interested in this question of what was it structurally that differentiated the relationship between homosexuality in the New Left and homosexuality in the old left. And that represented a question of both how homosexuality changed, but also how the left changed. And so I was sort of unsurprised with some of what I found. So, for example, The Liberator, which was the predecessor to New Masses, which probably became the most signature magazine of the left and eventually the Communist Party in the 20s and 30s, published this cartoon in April of 1922 of two sort of recognizable pansy figures with the caption, "Paul, isn't it horrifying that the perfume maker's strike is still on?" So you get this sort of narrative that, of course, these queens are irritated by the labor movement getting in the way of their gender inversion. New Masses in 1926 offered this editorial cartoon, which seemed to have really, for New Masses, a surprising lack of any kind of politics behind it, other than your run-of-the-mill homophobia with another pansy-type figure sitting in a chair with his fancy little mustache there saying, responding to the waiter saying, "Hey, don't you see the sign reserved for ladies?" saying, "I can't see the teensiest, weensiest reason why I shouldn't sit here." You know, again, you get this collapsing of gender inversion, but there's also a sort of what I see as a bourgeois affect to this character as well, his snooty nose stuck up in the air there, that might also resonate with the leftist. That's the closest thing I can come up with for a leftist critique in this particular image. New Masses throughout the 1930s and 40s, and this is a topic that Professor Silber has obviously talked about in a Civil War context. A lot of the critique, though, of Roosevelt that was used oftentimes portrayed him in drag, and I've just selected a couple here as illustrations. This one of Roosevelt doing a kind of fancy boy dance of the Seven Veils with the, you know, the CWA is just about to drop away. And here's another one. You can't really make it out that well in this particular image, but this is Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, obviously, in drag, mooning over a picture of Stalin, which, of course, I'm sorry, not Stalin, that's so bad, Hitler. Ugh, I went off my script. Anyway, so... Yeah, well, no, it does change the dynamic.
He's mooning Stalin and Stalin.
Anyway, so, you know, so again, not to suggest that there was no distinction between gender inversion and homosexuality, but there was a lot of overlap in the cultural understanding of the relationship between gender and sexuality at this moment, and New Masses exploited that to no end. There were other examples outside of the visual realm. So, for example, and I don't think that you see this addressed that often in the literature, but in 1934, New Masses published an alarming editorial relating to Angelo Herndon, who was a famous communist organizer who was arrested and imprisoned for distribution of insurrectionary literature. And the editors actually advocated to try and have readers of New Masses write letters in 1934 to the governor of Atlanta because the prison warden had apparently threatened to put sex perverts into Herndon's prison cell. And so the actual language they used, they said, "In addition to the constant torture and unbearable conditions in the Fulton Tower death houses, sexual perverts are to be introduced into his cell." And so the ILD, who I think most of us associate with the defense of the Scottsboro Boys, actually encouraged readers of New Masses to send letters to the governor to try and demand that he be given rights of a political prisoner. Herndon himself, in his 1937 memoir, Let Me Live, noted that, quote, "Lovemaking was carried on between prisoners in full sight of everyone. Frequently, I had to turn my eyes away in disgust and pity." Now, none of these examples disrupt this kind of general consensus that seems to have developed that the relationship between the left, particularly the old left, and homosexuality was one marked by friction. So that's kind of the story that everybody knows. But what I was surprised to find when I started looking deeper into the archive was how frequently, and I would really venture to say how much more frequently, homosexuality actually came up in ways that were a lot more progressive than that, that weren't actually marked by that kind of friction, that actually were organized more around trying to develop some kind of sexual politics that saw the left as offering a sort of refuge or a habitat for trying to cultivate some kind of politics of homosexuality. So it's really that side of the story that I want to focus on here today. In a way, the homophobia on the left is unsurprising. As an historian, I'm not surprised to find homophobia in the 30s and 40s. That side of the story feels to me familiar. It feels, you know, like typical in American culture. But what I was really surprised to find was that there were actual ways in which the left was seen as a site of resistance to homophobia. And so that's really what I want to try and talk about today, though I'm certainly happy to talk more about the homophobic side too in the Q&A. And one other thing I want to mention here is that I think that one of the key points that, and this relates to the theme of the American conversations this year,
so
of cultural politics.
I forgot to mention that. Yeah.
Cultural politics, political culture. You know, one of the reasons that I think that this strong narrative of the homophobia and the old left has become so dominant is because of the fact that the Communist Party in 1938 passed in their bylaws rules banning degeneracy. And so there's been a sort of sense that if the Communist Party said it, everybody must have acted out in unilateral ways to carry out those kinds of policies. But, you know, that wasn't actually the case. So, for example, Junius Scales, who was the Southern organizer for the Communist Party, who actually did jail time for his member of the for his membership in the Communist Party, he was asked to turn in homosexuals in the 1940s for engaging in homosexual activity. And he had to figure out who these people were. So he had to ask everybody. And, you know, if you were involved in the Communist Party, you knew better than to lie to party officials. And he recounted in his later memoir, he said, quote, "The number of affirmative replies were startling. They came from young and old, men and women, Negro and white, married and single, workers and students. Two prominent Negro unionists, two outstanding student leaders, and others exceptional in their ability and activity included themselves among the homosexuals." So certainly the idea that the policy was keeping homosexuals out of the party doesn't seem to have been the case, and I'll expand on that more in a moment. But additionally, Scales refused to turn in these names. So the idea that this policy that was laid down by the party automatically turned into practice on the ground is also not necessarily the case either. The other side of that, so that's kind of the political culture side, the cultural politics side I'm going to say a lot more on as we move forward here, but let me turn here to a couple other examples. So I want to focus on a couple of case studies here of actual homosexuals in the Communist Party and how their relationship to the party related to their sexuality, to try and get a sense of what that experience was like, what the culture was like in the party, and how it was used by a couple of key individuals to sort of map out something more complicated than this relationship, saying, you know, that points just to party policy. And the first person that I want to mention here is John Malcolm Brennan. Has anybody heard of Brennan, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So John Malcolm Brennan is a fairly well-known person, particularly among, here's a picture of him, though I should read this image, I don't have much to say about it. But Brennan is particularly known for his literary biographies, so he is known for, just to give one example, for writing this wonderful biography of Gertrude Stein called The Third Rose, which is apparently the point in which a rose is a rose is a rose. Most Americans just stop. They don't want to get to the fourth rose. So anyway, he's mostly known as a biographer and a writer of literary criticism. But in the 40s, he was actually known as a poet. And he published, actually with Macmillan, and a few volumes of fairly well-respected verse. He was also a homosexual. Fairly unconflicted, as far as I can tell, through looking through his papers since at least the age of 19. And he was a member of the Communist Party. He started out in the Young Communist League. And he actually wasn't a sort of fellow traveler, you know, who moved, you know, sort of in communist circles but never joined the party. He was one of the people who, when the Nazi-Soviet pact sort of drove a lot of people out of the party, stayed in the party and defended that pact to other people. He was a fairly committed leftist here. In 1936, a couple months before his 30th birthday, and at the height of what's become known as the Red Decade, Brennan took a trip to the Soviet Union, and he left behind his same-sex lover, Keeman Fryer. When he was on the boat to the Soviet Union, he wrote a letter to Fryer, who was himself also a communist and also a poet, and I'll get to that in a moment. I don't expect you to actually read the letter here. I just think it's interesting that it's on this letterhead. So he wrote in this letter, Russia looms before me now, looms great before me now. I'm ready to meet it full-hearted. Hold with your communist lover, Kiemann. You are more to him than manifestos, banners, or 1,000 nations. And that's the sort of closing of the letter. For Brennan, identifying as a communist and a same-sex lover held no contradiction. Brennan's full-hearted affection for both the revolution and his romantic partner made frequent appearance in his correspondence with Fryer over the next decade or so, and his relationship with his communist lover was intimately connected with their shared investment in leftist politics, radical community, and the Soviet dream. Shortly thereafter, Brennan wrote another lonely, beseeching letter to Fryer, this time from Kiev, where Brennan had been exploring the Soviet Union and experiencing a confusing complex of mixed emotions. Being in Russia without his beloved Kiemann left Brennan feeling bittersweet. Quote, if thoughts were actualities, he pined, you would have identity in Red Square, the teeming streets of Moscow, the lonely steps, every spot I have been. Again, the experience of visiting the Soviet Union, a land that represented all their shared political aspirations, while Fryer languished at home, put Brennan in a desperately romantic mood. Quote, we have so much to build together, he determinedly wrote, that it is a whole life itself, and I am such an anxious architect. That's the end of the quote there. Whether building a romantic union or communist utopia, this architect would not say. The fundamental ambiguity introduced through the world to be built seeped into each of the missives Brennan dispatched from his journey, as it did in his ongoing relationship with Fryer. Political gestures often doubled for Brennan as romantic ones. Quote, several days ago, I ordered 2 copies of Spain, Brennan wrote to Fryer as the Spanish Civil War developed into the central communist cause of the late 1930s. One for you and one for me. Was there ever a more loving identity in the practical world or in the sentimental? End quote. Probably not. And Brennan was quite the master of collapsing the practical and the sentimental. It was then this precise collapsing of sexual longing, romantic desire, and radical vision that best characterized Brennan's relationship to homosexuality and the left. If he failed to produce a political narrative that comprehensively brought these pursuits into alignment, his capacity for highlighting their potential for coexistence and even inextricability suggests a common theme among those radicals who also balanced homosexuality and leftist orientations in the 20s and 30s. Brennan, as I mentioned, was a poet, as was Fryer back at home. Brennan wrote many poems about his lover, some of which appeared in his collections, and Fryer, for his part, responded to Brennan's queer revolutionary overtures in kind, such as in 1936, when Fryer himself sent a poet for Brennan, given the title Revolutionary Love, an Intimate Mosaic, and this is just a piece of it here. Poet, whose soul resembles mine, O heart, whose heart is like mine. The young only outface despair to fashion out of dreams and rhyme, radiant, firm new voices flown in luminous signatures of air. We shall exalt with love like ours, flaunting the transatlantic breeze, poets whose resolute songs foment hammer and sickle through risen shores, planting a joyous, blossoming peace where we may lie together in the end. For Fryer, as for Brennan, revolutionary verse lent itself nicely to acts of revolution, and lying in a land marked by revolution was inseparable for lying together in the end. I'm accentuating Brennan's story for 2 reasons. First, Brennan's story gives lie to the myth of homosexual invisibility and leftist neglect of homosexuals. While that might have been true on an organizational level, clearly there was some level on which individuals within the left were able to bring these 2 pursuits into some kind of resolution. In this, he represented a case that was actually not especially atypical. I want to give 1 other example here of gay communist leftists who were in a relationship and also in the party, the case, which is a little bit more well-known, of Grace Hutchins and Anna Rochester. Hutchins and Rochesters were communists who were also in a lesbian relationships. Their relationship has actually been widely documented. They were devoted to the party and each other, and their romantic partnership was also often framed through their political commitments. In 1943, Anna Rochester wrote Hutchins a birthday poem celebrating their shared personal and political struggle. This is the whole poem. Warm heart, clear brain, straight back, no pain. Friend to many, loved by all, spring of youth. Though nearly 60, heeds the call of truth and struggle. Dear Grace, beloved Grace. Again, you get that collapsing of political romance, but also personal romance, and of course, same-sex affection and intimacy here. Okay, so the first reason is to show that clearly not everybody who was both a leftist and a homosexual saw this as a space of friction. You know, there were opportunities to be able to try and develop something of a more symbiotic relationship between these pursuits. But the other reason that I'm particularly interested in these stories is because of the presence of poetry in each of them. The emphasis upon poetry in the lives of these four gay leftists particularly points to the cultural left as a significant site for developing a relationship with the old left that encompasses homosexuality. Now, I'm, of course, drawing in my title of my talk in referencing the cultural front, some of the work in the cultural history of the left that has tried to imagine how the cultural left offered opportunities that incorporated sometimes a broader vision for what the left could do and what the left could mean than was necessarily sanctioned in official party documents. And I think that the opportunities, particularly through things like poetry, literature, visual art, even things like writing letters to magazine and reading those and sometimes writing back to them, offers a space where those kinds of behaviors and those kinds of individuals who found themselves pushed to the margins of party life, of the politically organized left, oftentimes could be articulated in ways that were more robust or perhaps more complicated. One of the sites for this kind of work that I think is most interesting is in the magazine New Masses, which I've already mentioned before in relation to its homophobia. I should mention that the images and the references that I found and that I put up earlier, none of that has gone into the understanding of the Communist Party as being homophobic. Those are not things that have been addressed by other scholars who have really mostly restricted it to the records of the party itself. New Masses was widely perceived in the 1930s and 40s, 20s, 30s, and 40s, I'll say, as a place where sexuality was dealt with in all kinds of ways, in a somewhat open, sometimes bohemian way. So, you know, all kinds of sexuality was represented in New Masses: monogamous, promiscuous, homosexual, heterosexual, married, free-loving, paid in cash. It didn't matter. New Masses had a place for it. And they had a lot of fun with it, too. For example, in 1927, they actually staged an anti-obscenity ball, sort of mocking the way that they tended to be targeted by critics who saw the magazine as obscene for dealing so much in this content. And you can't read all the fun little things, and I can't read them either right now because it's too small on my screen. But trust me when I say they're hilarious. with these ironic ways of trying to make fun of the anti-obscenity campaigns that keep targeting New Masses. One of the things that I think was motivating, oh, and I also, you know, there's this famous Coit Tower mural by Victor Arnatov that shows this red sweater radical kind of leering over at the viewer as he looks like he might be about to pick up a copy of the Daily Worker and New Masses, which I think nicely demonstrates the kind of collapsing of what kind of secrecy, what kind of deviance is going into reading this kind of radical literature. But I'll come back to that later. One of the things that I think motivated New Masses to talk about sex so much is that they were trying to reclaim some of the sexual exuberance of the 1920s, so often characterized as the Gatsby-esque roaring 20s, jazz age culture. They wanted to pull that back from the upper crust, to remind readers that working class values cultivated over a century's worth of burgeoning labor organization and proletarian self-identification offered a far more liberating foundation for sexual freedom and radical sex practices upon which to build a revolution than the trendy sexual experimentation that emerged out of prosperity's ennui. the editor's sort of editorial spin on puritanical suppression of sexuality had reached its height in the anti-obscenity ball, but there were many examples in which New Masses was unabashed about specifically thinking about homosexuality. I'm going to give, or I should say, I sort of the language of homosexuality, queer, all of these language, I can go into detail maybe in the Q&A as to how I'm choosing between them, but in this case I have to expand to queer representations. But I want to give a few examples of where in New Masses this kind of material came up. So, for example, in 1926, in its very first year of publication, New Masses published a story by Ivan Beattie titled Birdie, a Love Story, about a young man named Birdie whose love was spurned by his friend Paul. The story is deeply sympathetic to the young homosexual man. It's not mocking, it's not satirical, it's not built upon class lines where the homosexual is the bourgeois, you know, person and the person spurning him as this shocked and horrified leftist. It was just a sort of sympathetic portrait of homosexuality. Albert Maltz, the novelist and screenwriter who was later known as one of the members of the Hollywood Ten, published a story titled Onward Christian Soldiers about an encounter between a businessman and a male street hustler, which again tried to add this sort of class critique of sex work, homosexual sex work, and that appeared in 1934. In 1935, William J. Rollins enthusiastically defended his decision to include a homosexual character named Olson, who instigates the Gastonia strike, which, if you know anything about leftist labor history in the 30s, was a real flashpoint for the leftist labor movement. You know, in his fictionalization of the Gastonia strike, he actually put a homosexual character's love for one of the people involved in the strike at the center of how the strike happened. He almost made it a homosexual love story. He openly defended including the homosexual character Olson, who he did identify as a homosexual character in that language, in his 1935 article, What is a Proletarian Writer? Perhaps most surprising to me was to discover that in 1929, a letter writer from San Joaquin, California, actually wrote a letter to the editor and, for all intents and purposes, came out. The letter was a bit of a strange letter. It was written in the third person, but HHC talks about all of his love that he can't name, laments how the world scorned him, hated him for it, and then announced at the end of his letter, there's a gate somewhere, but he is a coward. Again, it's written in the third person and will not open it, and then declared, the New Masses has helped to show him the gate, declaring that someday soon he will walk out and find life and be worthy of himself and life. This was surprising to me. It gave lie to a lot of the ways that I'd understood homosexuality in relation to the old left. But what was even more surprising was two issues later, New Masses posted a notice for college student HHC and noted a number of letters had been received for HHC and asked that the HHC, who apparently hadn't given his name, you know, it's still not the 70s, hadn't given his name and address, said, send us your name and address. We want to forward these letters to you. Again, this is I don't know what's in the letters. I haven't been able to track down those letters. But, you know, I have a hunch. And either way, it suggests that people were motivated to try and get in touch with this person in the midst of this process. So certainly this suggests, again, a slightly more complicated narrative of this relationship than I had previously come to understand. Okay, now one of the reasons that I think that the left was seen by many homosexuals as being a place to look for this kind of sympathy, because as I said, it clearly wasn't the party saying, we're a big tent, come on in. It was really happening the other way. It was much more a matter of homosexuals or people with homosexual inclinations seeking out the leftists as being a possibly hospitable place. And one of the ways that I've sort of been able to make sense of that is by thinking about what Stuart Hall in the 1970s has referred to as, in deviance theory, thinking about political and social deviance. So the way in which thinking about this broad conceptualization of deviance creates sites of overlap, both in terms of identity, but also in terms of the spaces that one is forced to occupy, that actually placed homosexuals and leftists within the same geography, and also created a common vocabulary. So within the same geography, you get all kinds of accounts of homosexual leftists during the period of the old left being forced to intermingle simply because the spaces where they're relegated to are the same spaces. So for example, Jim Kepner, who was later a member of the founding of Mattachine, which is one of the first actual homophile organizations. He actually has written or wrote about how in the 1940s, he would cruise for sex in Pershing Square in Los Angeles and then go to a Marxist meeting in the same park. And a lot of the spaces, if you actually do the maps, if you put the maps into Google Maps or something like that, you can actually see that places like Washington Park in Chicago are places where, you know, Marie Houston is giving these lectures to African Americans that are attracting on Marxism to African Americans. And this is also the same park where, you know, just feet away, Kevin Mumford has written about homosexual cruising taking place during the same time period. So there was a lot of physical overlap. And, you know, deviants thinking about this as being, if you're a communist, you're already enacting some kind of social and political deviance. If you're a homosexual, you're already doing kind of the same thing. Thinking about this shared language of deviance has been helpful to me in thinking about why this might have been the case. And when you look at the historical record, there's a long history of leftists being associated with sexual deviance and also gender inversion, which I think is important to again see that there's some kind of intersection between gender inversion and sexual deviance in a lot of the you know, culture that's produced at this time. So socialism, you know, in 1904, the San Francisco Call had warned that there were many long-haired men in San Francisco, and socialism had been charged as appealing to primarily, quote, the long-haired men and short-haired women. Now, you know, again, it's not explicitly homosexual, but this slippery fashion marker certainly pointed to something that was easy to make a leap to sexual inversion as well. The idea of communists as being inherently sexually a little odd was also a dominant part of the narrative. Beatrice Lumpkin just recently published a memoir with the beautiful line in it: "Only communists or prostitutes would be seen in public without a hat." So you get all kinds of spaces where communists were articulating themselves as being pushed to the margins. You know, we're seen as prostitutes and things like this. We're seen as deviant. And of course, during the Cold War, that kind of collapse of sexual and social deviance becomes just part of the national lexicon. But you know, this is something that has long roots and long history that I can't fully go into. But in the 1930s, it was played out in a lot of complicated ways as well. In 1935, H.T. Chang, who's one of the most fascinating writers of the decade, published his novel, The Hanging on Union Square, and it's one of the most gay things I've ever read in my life. And he wrote in that novel, he had a butch female communist in that novel blurt out at one point, "I don't believe in what's called a disgrace and what isn't called a disgrace." And I think that sense that communists don't know what's a disgrace and what's not a disgrace actually opens up this new possibility for making some kind of connection between the possibilities for deviance having political ends. Okay. So, I know I'm racing through a lot of material here, but I want to try and get through everything so we can have a good discussion. So what I want to do in the remainder of the time here, and I know it's short, I'm going to keep it to 50 minutes. In the remainder of the time here, what I want to do is to try and position three particular ways in which the Communist Party and the left more broadly as well. I don't want this to be only a communist history. But the left provided opportunities for intersection with homosexuality. And the three axes that I want to think about here are the axes of lifestyle, the rhetoric of anti-fascism, and particularly within the Communist Party, the articulations of race all three of these as being sites where homosexuality and the left were almost forced to intersect. Okay? So I'm going to go through that and then I'll be done. Bill Maxwell, who's a wonderful historian of the left, gave this talk I was at a couple of years ago, and through the entire talk he just kept saying, I'm just going to keep going all night. I'm just going to keep talking and talking and talking. It was so funny, and but I'm not going to do that. It would be very deviant to play that card. Anyway, okay, so first I want to start with this question of lifestyle. So within leftist literature, particularly in the 1930s and 40s, homosexuality and the left were often connected through representations of a shared lifestyle. So it didn't matter if whether it was homosexual, it didn't matter if it was leftist, what matters was it was a lifestyle. And you see a lot of writers during this time period exploiting that ambiguity strategically. I want to say intentionally, though I'm willing to concede the death of the author, it certainly points to a broad discourse that exists at this moment. So I'm just going to give one example of that. And there's a lot more. I'm just being selective here. In 1935, Tess Schlesinger, who's probably best known for having participated in the founding of the Menorah Journal and also having written a novel called The Unpossessed. In 1935, she published a short story called After the Party, which is already kind of a sly double meaning, that focuses on Mrs. Kilborn, a socialite and cocktail party hostess who recalls the disillusion of her marriage when her husband Henry comes out as a socialist. And I just want to read you some of the passages here where he comes out in this way. Oh yes, said Mrs. Colburn bravely. She had always known that Henry was a socialist at heart. He had been inclined that way even when she first met him, when they were both at school. It turned out that the socialists he picked up were really very presentable and gentlemanly and could be invited anywhere. Just fellows like himself who had been to Harvard, or at worst, sons of New England clergymen. End quote. Yet, Henry eventually chooses the lifestyle over his family. Quote, he was very quiet and abstracted for a week or so, and one night said to her quite clearly that they must have a talk. Henry said that he was planning to change the horizon of himself, change his whole way of life. End quote. What's evident here is how Schlesinger attends to the left as representing a form of identity and a lifestyle choice. It becomes symptomatic of perversion insofar as it suggests a retreat from a narrative of family, an entering into a community, and a break from the normativity of past experience. So this means a breaking off of the marriage and a movement into a broader community. To me, that feels an awful lot like coming out, even if it's not a coming out sexually. One of the things that the lifestyle on the left also introduced was the opportunity for women and men to also be represented and to think about themselves outside of traditional gender norms. And I know that's a fraught phrase. Traditional is not a historically accurate phrase. I'm trying to use a shorthand to get through this. But the left offered opportunities to really think critically about what gender meant in terms of gender performance during this time period, during the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And so I think that that also was appealing to a lot of the leftists who also were thinking about their sexuality. And, you know, we find this in a lot of letters as well and a lot of other representations. But I just want to give an example here of one of each, okay? Gender inversion of butch women and femme men, even though I think we tend to think about the left in terms of masculine men. This is, you know, the image in the poster for this event should have tipped my hand a little bit. So this is a cartoon that appeared in The Liberator in 1921. And it's, if you can read it, on the top there is Rebuilding Civilization. The woman on the left is branded communist. That's all that it says on her. The woman on the left, the woman on the right, rather, on the left, you have the profit system, parliament, and capitalism. And the caption at the bottom is, you can't do it in those clothes, you know. For women in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, the left offered all kinds of opportunities for representations of butch. There were representations of butch in proletarian fiction all over the place. There were representations of butch in magazines and newspapers and journals. And this really allowed for an expansive range of representations of women that oftentimes became literalized through representations of butch lesbians. Not always. Sometimes a butch is just a butch, but at times it could actually open the door to actually make